Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, a series of coordinated attacks in Paris injured more than 350 people and took the lives of nearly 130 others. The French government has since sealed its borders and increased security, and overnight, French police and army troops advanced on an apartment in a northern Paris suburb. A gun battle ensued, and then an explosion. It ended with two dead suspects and seven other arrests. Today, we're talking about the war on terrorism in France and security issues here in the States. Joining us now by phone is from Paris is Washington Post Pentagon reporter Missy Ryan. Welcome to the show, Missy.
Thank you.
You wrote this morning about a police raid on an apartment in a northern Paris suburb. Do you know yet what was achieved?
Well, we know that there were two suspects who died in the pre-dawn raid. It took place. It started around 4:30 a.m. And lasted for about 6 hours. Police had apparently gotten some information, either a tip or intelligence, that there could have been militants at this apartment and possibly even this figure who's believed to be one of the ringleaders of the Friday attacks. His name is Abdelhamid Abaoud. He's a Belgian of Moroccan descent. And so they assembled a large team of elite French police and military forces, and they advanced on the apartment. One suspect blew herself up with a suicide vest, and another suspect was killed. We don't know exactly how or who that was. And then there were a number of arrests, a few people in the apartment and then people around on the scene. We don't know yet whether Abaoud was there. So we're waiting in a couple of hours. There's going to be a press conference by the Paris prosecutor, and we're hoping to get more information then. But certainly, if he was apprehended or if he was the second suspect who was killed, it would be a huge development for the French authorities at a time where they're really trying to show the public that they're in control of the situation.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the violence, the terrorist attacks in France, in Paris, with Missy Ryan. She's a Washington Post Pentagon reporter talking to us from France. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Tell us about this Belgian man that authorities are have focused their attention on, Abaoud.
So he spent most of his childhood in this hardscrabble area of Brussels, Molenbeek, and it's known to be, or it has emerged as sort of a hotbed for militancy in a European capital. And he became radicalized and is believed to have gone to Syria in 2013 or 2014. And is since then has been believed to be involved in plotting of several failed attacks, including an attack on a train earlier this year. And so he was definitely on the radar of Western intelligence. But, you know, up until this week, it was unclear whether he was in Syria or whether he was back in Europe. And now it appears that he was back in Europe. And, you know, he's just, you know, his sort of path reflects the appeal that the Islamic State has to some Europeans who feel perhaps disenfranchised or attracted by the sort of romanticism of what the Islamic State is sort of selling its mission in the Middle East, and or for whatever reason they decide to sign up. Abaoud apparently convinced his 13-year-old brother to join him fighting in Syria. So that's obviously a measure of his commitment to their cause.
How he got back into France, maybe by way of traveling with Syrian refugees, has been a big issue because it's sort of triggered this anti-refugee movement into the United States. What do they think about that in France now that the president there has said they're going to allow, I think it was 40,000 more refugees from Syria?
So, you know, we don't yet know whether the attackers used the migrant pass to get back into Europe. There's certainly some suspicions. They are all European passport holders. So, though, you know, the appearance of one of the attackers had a Syrian passport on him when he conducted the attack, but it's since been confirmed that the passport was fake. So we don't really know the details of that, but the suspicion that one or more of them could have used these migrant routes to get back into Europe obviously has reinforced fears. But what we saw today was Hollande, an address that he made here in Paris, sort of reinforcing the fact that his government would stick to plans to accept refugees. You know, France isn't the primary destination for most refugees. More end up in Greece, Italy initially, and then they're headed often for Germany or for the UK. But he promised to accept tens of thousands of refugees within the next 2 years and also increase the amount of money set aside for refugee housing.
We know that the borders were sealed after the attacks last week. How have security measures changed in France and I guess across Europe? How much do you know about that in response to the attacks?
Well, on France, on Friday, Hollande instated a state of emergency, and that has allowed police to sort of lower the bar in terms of, the arrests and questioning that they conduct in Paris and around the country. And now Hollande is seeking a 3-month extension for that state of emergency. So that's one indication of, what he is trying to do, along with some constitutional changes, actually, that he's proposing to try to sort of tighten the vise among, potential sympathizers or potential attackers. And, just generally speaking in Europe, you've seen just a lot of tension. Last night in Hanover, Germany, there was a crowded soccer stadium that was evacuated quite quickly right before a friendly soccer match began. And that was because there had been what German authorities said was a credible bomb plot. And there was another music venue that was evacuated. Today, I think there was an airport terminal that was temporarily shut down. In another part of Europe, there were two Air France airplanes that were diverted yesterday. And so you can just see that everybody's on edge. And, there is certainly a desire to take any threat seriously at this moment.
France has invoked a European Union mutual aid pact, and it calls for members of that bloc to assist other member states if they're attacked. How will this work? I mean, how can fellow European countries respond, given their own budget constraints and also divisions over the military and how military is used?
Yeah, so this was approved yesterday by European officials in Brussels, and it's something that Hollande requested. You know, I think it's more symbolic than anything. It's never happened before, so I think it's noteworthy. And European countries are committing their support, but even the French government acknowledged yesterday that the discussions need to take place still to sort of figure out what new commitments, if there are any, will be forthcoming. And already, the German government has come out and said that they will not begin doing airstrikes in Syria. So already you can see countries saying, yes, we want to help you, but we have our own sort of political sensitivities and obviously budget constraints, as you said, to keep in mind. So I'm not expecting any major changes there.
So you wrote something earlier this week that I wanted to follow up on that while the expanding investigation produced used the word tantalizing clues about possible plotters, it also underscored the limitations of Western security agencies as they face homegrown terrorism plots. And I wondered what those limits are and whether that has something to do with the constitutional changes that President Hollande called for.
Sure. I mean, every country in Europe has its own sort of set equilibrium point for, how much access the government is going to have into, the lives of their citizens. In countries like the United Kingdom, it's, more intrusive than in other countries. So I think that Europe, like in the United States, is going through a process of trying to figure out what they're comfortable with and what they feel is necessary. I think that that's one thing. And then the other thing is a question of effectiveness that's unique to the European Union in terms of the effectiveness of intelligence sharing and the sort of cross-European setup where you have different countries' intelligence agencies, and most of them share information on a bilateral basis. Is that the best way to do it? Maybe not. You had a situation here where there were residents of Belgium apparently planning an attack in Belgium on France. And so you can see there where there's going to be some sort of finger pointing about, you know, who's responsible for what. And that really is compounded by a situation where you have lots of people coming in from outside of the union and, you know, they're being checked at every stage along the way. I'm talking about migrants. And so that, you know, will make what, you know, the country like Croatia on the migrant route, what they do more important to France because these people could end up in France.
What about that? Why France? What do we know about why France was targeted in this way at this time and at that level?
Well, you know, France has been a participant in the operations against the Islamic State for some time. They're the second largest contributor of airstrikes after the United States. Now it's a distant second. There is no other country that's near as active from a military perspective, the U.S. and Iraq and Syria. You know, I mean, France has been very vocal that they're willing to, you know, take on extremist Islam. You know, there's also the historical dimension to think about. You know, I was watching yesterday, there were two new videos released by supporters of the Islamic State praising the Paris attacks and sort of warning Europe of more to come. And there was one of the, you know, Islamic State fighters who was talking in the video, and he kept saying, you know, this is about history. We don't forget the decades of oppression, you know, France that you perpetrated. You know, and if you're thinking about the history of, you know, the colonial history, North Africa and the Levant, you know, I mean, there's, you know, rightly or wrongly, things that people could talk about in that arena. And I think that that's something to keep in mind of why France. You know, France has a long history with some of the countries from which these attackers are plotting and from their, you know, their sort of ancestral links.
Why the apparent, at least from where we sit, sudden use of the Arabic name for the Islamic State? Is it Daesh or Daesh?
Daesh? Daesh. So Daesh is, you know, the Arabic acronym for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And, you know, it's the reason why people in the West and in many Arab countries use it is because it's a name that sort of doesn't give the validation to the Islamic State of calling them a state. And it's something that the Islamic State supporters don't like.
Okay.
So in some ways, it's a way to slight that and not, you know, give them the affirmation of, you know, saying that they're equal to a country like, you know, the state of Iraq or, you know, the state of France.
Sort of like the way the president, President Obama, continues to use the acronym ISIL.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you see some American officials using Daesh, too, for the same reason, because they think that, you know, they hear Arab allies making the case for why that's significant. So, you know, it's not uniform, but there are definitely people within the U.S. government who also use that term.
All right. Well, Missy Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
No problem.
Missy Ryan, she is Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. We're speaking to her where she is at in Paris. Coming up, more conversation about the attacks on Paris, what it means to U.S. foreign policy going forward. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The terrorist attacks in Paris last week have triggered renewed criticism of the Obama administration's handling of ISIS. A large stable of Republican presidential hopefuls has spiced the rhetoric as well. Yesterday, Ohio Governor John Kasich in a national security speech suggested increased coordination with NATO.
Friday's attacks were an act of war by ISIS on France and therefore they were an attack on America and every other NATO member state. NATO came to our aid after 9/11. NATO must now do so again for France. We must be swift, we must be decisive, and we must be absolute.
Kasich also indicated that he would support putting troops on the ground in the war against ISIS. Joining us now by phone is director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Sean Kay. Welcome back as always, Sean.
Good morning.
And in the studio, professor and department chair of political science at Ohio State University, Richard Herman. Welcome back, Rick.
Good to be here, Ann.
So let's talk first about President Obama's strategy. His plan is to cripple ISIS through airstrikes and with assistance to local forces. He has said that he was making progress. Rick Herman, this is going to be a long slog. He said that all along.
Yes, it's hard to see the progress, and I'm not sure there's a lot there. Part of the problem is that we can continue to try to contain them with bombing and the like, but we're not going to defeat ISIS until there's a political government in both Baghdad and Damascus that appeal to Sunnis and can start to pull off support from ISIS among the Sunni. And we're far away from that. And consequently, there's tons of people still ready to fight for ISIS. And that's the central problem, it seems to me. So we can continue to attack where we can, where we can diminish their military capacity to some extent. I think eventually to really change them, you'd need boots on the ground and lots of them. And they would have to be Arab boots leading the way. And none of those, or maybe some Turkish help. And nobody's talking about that in any big way. I just saw a report this morning in the Washington Post that even among Republican voters, more than 50% say no troops on the ground. And, you know, there's just not enthusiasm for what would actually be necessary to truly move this forward any more quickly than what President Obama is doing.
Yeah, I don't even know what we mean by boots on the ground anymore. Anyways, it seems like a whack-a-mole operation. Sean Kay, what do you make of it?
Well, I think Rick used a key word that I think our policy actually has been a little confusing, because I think we have actually been mainly trying to contain ISIS and gradually roll them back inside of Iraq and Syria, because as Rick said, despite the rhetoric of all tools to bear on this, even those who are most assertive about wanting to get involved there on the military side generally do not want to talk about what kind of troops it would take and also how much it would cost. I mean, hundreds perhaps of billions of dollars, maybe even more than that, you know, rebuilding Syria, rebuilding Iraq again, and so on and so forth. So I think the policy has been actually not one of decimating them in the near term, but rather containing them. And the dilemma for the administration is you can actually talk about rollback on the ground, but there's still likely to be these serious and very disturbing asymmetrical attacks as that also rolls forward.
Governor Kasich unveiled a litany of security policy issues in his speech yesterday before, I think it was the Washington Press Club or the National Press Club. He talked about boots on the ground. Is that just rhetoric at this point, or does he know what he's talking about?
We have troops on the ground. I mean, there are more than 3,000 or 4,000 American troops there. There can be more. I you know, the governor's right that we defend NATO states, but we've been at this now for months. I guess we can do more to support France. France started to support us in some of the bombing attacks in early September, and have been doing that for the last few months. They've escalated it in the last few days, but they've been in this for several months already with us, but we were the leading force to start with. So I guess we can all escalate, but the notion that we have to now go to NATO and start something all brand new, I think, is misguided. It's already going on. It's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah.
One of the problems with the bombing that we're doing now, I'm told that somewhere about 50% of all the ordnance that's on the planes that are flying on these bombing missions come back unused because they can't get clear shots on targets that wouldn't involve a lot of collateral death. And bombing lots of civilians who happen to be captured in the ISIS areas is not going to win us the kind of political headway we need. You know, during the last surge period when in 2007 to 2008 in Iraq, the United States put 100,000 troops in and was able to suppress violence. But we made almost no headway on the political issues that were dividing Iraq, mm-hmm. not on the Kurdish issue, not on the distribution of oil resources, not on the Sunni-Shia split, none of this. And so in that sense, the surge was sort of a political failure, even if it was a military success. And I think this is what President Obama is faced with now. We can have some military success. We could blow up more people. We could hit them harder, as the governor said, absolute. But it'll be a political huge counter effect in the sense if you're killing lots of civilians and driving more people to ISIS rather than separating them from them. So you'd have to have, as we did in the search, many troops who would be there to protect the population from ISIS retaliation against them if they ally with the United States. And that would mean you'd have to be there 24/7 in a protective mode over these civilian populations or have Arab forces that can come in and do that. And none of that seems to me is going to be stable and sustainable when the governments in Damascus and Baghdad are hated by the Sunni.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Of course, we're talking about the war against ISIS is what we're calling it today. It could be called something different tomorrow. It depends. If you have a question or comment for my guests, Dr. Richard Herman, he's professor and department chair of political science at OSU, and also Sean Kay, director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sean Kay, did you want to add to that? Or?
Well, I think the NATO appeal is it sounds good politically, but realistically, NATO doesn't work the way Governor Kasich has suggested it does. America doesn't just pronounce that. 29 different countries would have to agree, and not every European country agrees that they want to get pulled into NATO being a military response to this. It doesn't mean that shouldn't happen, but I think that already is going on with the operational activities that have been agreed to so far. I think more likely you're going to see, as you your earlier segment suggests, that the Europeans are going to push this through the European Union because it's also there where they're going to have to deal seriously with this refugee flow problem. So I don't think it's likely to see NATO get further involved in this. The other big problem, though, is that our policy also is that we want to overthrow the government of Syria. And the problem is the Syrian government is also the government trying to kill ISIS, in addition to a number of other people. And then you've got the Russians and the French now sort of aligned with that. So, you know, where we stand in terms of our medium and long-term goals is actually quite vague and unclear. So some kind of decision is going to have to be made, at least in the medium term. If we want to put serious military damage on the ISIS, then we're probably going to have to think hard about what we're trying to accomplish in terms of a stable Syria. And that's going to require some significant talk now with the Russians and also the French, of course.
Right. And when you talk about France becoming more aligned with that in terms of – are you talking about France is more aligned with the Assad regime in terms of
– No, not necessarily, okay. But being more active militarily inside of Syria, to be sure.
What about that idea of a grand coalition with Russia and the U.S.? What does that say to you? Is that just more – of the same?
I mean, I just want to mention that France and Turkey were very early opponents of Assad and have been very much opposed to Assad.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's very unlikely that either Turkey or France is going to say it's okay that Assad stay. And over the last several weeks, talks have begun. Secretary of State Kerry is very central in them to try to bring about some agreement between the Russians and the French and the Turks and others that Assad must go. And then that's part of whatever this coalition is that's put together. The Russians aren't fully agreed with that yet, but it looks to me like that's maybe within the realm of a diplomatic possibility. And that would make a big change, I think.
Yeah.
So I think that is something to keep our eyes on. In terms of the Grand Coalition, right now, best I can see, they're just trying to make sure they don't fly into each other's planes, what they call deconflicting. And they're trying to avoid that. The Russians haven't been bombing ISIS primarily, but now apparently they are. There's no doubt in my mind the Russians will be fiercely against ISIS and against al-Nusra. They are very much opposed to this Islamic fundamentalist group. Obviously, Assad is a socialist. His father was allied with the Soviet Union for a long time. They're secular, and the Russians have Muslims inside Russia that they worry about.
Becoming radicalized as
well. Sure, in Chechnya and elsewhere. And they've had, Chechen terrorism in Russia. Some of it's just awful. So they're very firm on this issue. The Russians are.
How, as far as U.S.-Russia relations, how do they impact how they would work together or separately in regards to Syria, Sean Kay?
Well, I think they have had in the last month or so some useful military-to-military contacts about how to deconflict over the skies in Syria, and that's very important because accidents can lead to serious complications. There is this classic line that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and I'm sure that there can be some tactical advantage perhaps brought by the Russians. But Rick's absolutely right. The other dilemma with regard to the Assad leaving is that it's an essential element of the other groups inside of Syria that are also fighting, and that we also would want to incentivize to fight against ISIS. So that's an issue. And then one other bigger question too is that despite this call for maybe U.S. troops more on the ground, that kind of thing, one thing we've learned very difficultly in Iraq and Afghanistan is that the presence of troops on the ground can de-incentivize local partners, local people, from actually taking the risk that they need to take. And so that's part of the mix here, which is try to figure out how to incentivize local actors to take responsibility here for the future of the situation. And that's not going to happen for some lengthy period of time. So we're going to have to be patient as we see this roll forward.
Yeah, I was reading a Washington Post article about a town that ISIS had taken and how they had taken it. And when the townspeople rose up against them, they were slaughtered. I mean, they slaughtered everybody, Rick Herman. This is not a German occupation of Paris. This is slaughterhouses.
Yeah, from what I can see, the ISIS leadership is a combination of former military commanders of the Iraqi army under Saddam Hussein, who ruled by brutal terror and intimidation. And they're returning to that, where if they can terrorize the population into submission, then they can govern them more easily because no one will dare challenge them. And they've allied themselves with, religious groups that use the religious symbology. But I think you're right. I mean, this is what they've been doing, inflicting terror and hopes that they can intimidate any opposition to them.
Or kill it all off.
Well, I don't think they can kill it all off. There's just, a huge civilian population that eventually they want to rule over through intimidation. That's the way Saddam Hussein's regime held in power for decades.
What about that coalition of former Iraqi military under this Saddam Hussein and
Al Qaeda Iraq is what this used to be,
and these Islamic fundamentalists. I mean, was the Iraqi military not necessarily as secular as the Saddam Hussein government was? They're glad to go in together with these.
Apparently, some of them were probably somewhat religious to start with, but politics leads to expediency, and wanting to return to power and to empower the Sunni again would lead them to cooperate with whoever they think can make mass-based appeals. I think they probably were religious. I mean, I don't know these men individually. How religious were they versus how secular they were in Saddam's regime?
Right.
They clearly were achievement oriented and wanted power.
Sean Kay, is that at all a fault line or not necessarily?
Well, in that sense, we're combating the same problem we've been combating there since 2003 for a very long time. And I think we need to, before we start, I think it's really important to reflect a little bit on the lessons that we've learned so far. And what's interesting is it's a pretty good story in Politico about this today. I'd urge listeners to take a look at detailing that that's actually the military in the Pentagon that appear to be most hesitant about getting more involved on the ground in these areas. And that's because they've seen this before. And secondly, they also understand that any element of strategy that's going to be successful here is going to, at the end of the day, be political and diplomatic and involve a lot of civilian effort. And so, they're a little reluctant to be the tip end of the spearhead here. And so, when you talk about the actual needs, if you really want to, quote unquote, do something here, I mean, the former deputy director of the CIA said that we would need 100,000 troops on the ground. And so if we're really, this is a continual problem in U.S. foreign policy at our our feelings and our aspirations get way ahead of what we're actually willing to do. And I wouldn't just add troops on the ground, but the actual financial costs that we would have to come to bear as well.
Hmm. Something I wanted to mention in response to that, or in addition to that, this time with France closely allied with us, and I think other European countries will come along as part of NATO with this, we're much closer to our allies than we were before.
Yeah.
I heard the governor say, Governor Kasich say yesterday that our allies have drifted away. That may be true with Saudi Arabia, and maybe there's some tension with Israel, but it's certainly not true with regard to the Europeans. In the view, the people I view as our real allies, NATO, they're much closer to the Obama administration than they were, say, for example, the Bush administration. The French are arm-in-arm with us and have been. The only European country that was willing to go with Obama and bomb Syria back when we were having that big red line issue was France. England bailed out, but not France. France has been a leader on this one, as has and Germany's been very tough with regard to the Iranian nuclear program. So as we go into this, and of course, obviously what's just happened in Paris and what happened in Paris in the winter has led them to come with us. So if there have to be major Western forces put into the region, I think this time around it won't only be American, but I think it also must be that a coalition that includes Saudi Arabia and some of those Gulf states, who I presume Governor Kasich was thinking as of as our allies. But frankly, you know, those allies are responsible for a good bit of what we're facing here with ISIS. And they have, in my view, not taken the leadership role they need to, or in Turkey, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Are they not being pressured to take that leadership role, Sean Kay?
Well, I mean, again, if the Saudis, for example, feel we'll take care of it for them, then they kind of feel like they get a blank check. I would like to add one other quick sort of geopolitical problem that comes in the European context, too. It's also why we would be a little reluctant, perhaps, to put this all tied up into NATO, is because this is, in the immediate term, I mean, the French have already been talking directly to the Russians, somewhat of an opportunity to maybe rebuild up some of that cooperation with Russia on counterterrorism, separated from the Ukraine issues. But not all of Europe agrees in terms of the priority of threat, even despite what we're seeing on TV right now. If you live in the Baltic countries, your concern probably remains primarily Russia, whereas if you're in Italy or Greece or elsewhere, it's these refugees. And if you're in France, it's terrorism. And for the Russians, too, by the way, who just only over 10 days or so ago lost a civilian airliner, you know, and that's a big deal to them. So this is an opportunity for some cooperation, although we certainly, Putin has proven we can't be naive about his intentions. He'll do what he does. But it does, over the coming weeks and months, run the risk of creating actual divisions inside of NATO, with some wanting to mainly focus on concerns about Russia and others focused much more to their south.
We'll continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Since the terrorist attacks on Paris late last week, more than half of the U.S. governors, including John Kasich from Ohio, have called on the president to cease taking in any Syrian refugees. President Obama responded to that sentiment at the Group of 20 summit in Turkey.
We also have to remember that many of these refugees are the victims of terrorism themselves. That's what they're fleeing. Slamming the door in their faces would be a betrayal of our values.
Still with us by phone, director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Sean Kay. And in the studio with me, professor and department chair of political science at OSU, Rick Herman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So how safe are we, Rick Herman?
Well, I think this is one of the real problems that we're going to be facing now going forward. Just as the Americans understand perfectly the logic of us trying to fight over there and take the war into the Middle East so that it doesn't come here, I think what ISIS is trying to do is very logical, the same strategy in reverse, bring the war to us and make us feel the pain. And it won't be too hard for them to do that because it only takes a few people. In this most recent Paris case, it might come down to 8 or 10 people. And you know, many of them.
And who don't mind dying, as the president said.
And it isn't as if they were dispatched recently from Syria. One's a Belgian citizen, others are living in France, one's coming from Morocco. It isn't clear that they came in this new refugee. I think these two are two separate issues. There's the refugee flow, which are mostly victims, as best I can tell, who are trying to run away from the kind of regime ISIS wants to establish. But there are other people, some already here in Western societies and others who might be moving around the country and in small cells mobilized on the internet. And if ISIS has decided to try to take the war to the enemy, as they think about us, then we're moving into a much more dangerous period going forward, and it's going to take tremendous law enforcement efforts and surveillance efforts to keep people safe, or we're going to see more events like this.
Sean Kay, what do you think?
I agree with what Rick said. I would add one. I think in the intelligence community, there is somewhat of a slightly different assessment. For here in the United States, although their concerns are very, very valid, in large part because unlike in some of these big European cities, which have these, like in Brussels, as people have seen over TV, not far from where I used to live when I worked there, there's some pockets of communities that are just kind of locked in, and not integrated. Whereas the, Arab and Muslim communities in the United States are much, much more integrated into our system. And that's also why we want to show a sense of inclusiveness. You know, we want to make sure that people are not marginalized in society, that they're brought in. That seems to be one of the key tricks, that people can be susceptible to this kind of violent propaganda, especially that we see on the internet. And so the other concern, I think, has been sort of homegrown or, if you will, you know, sort of lone wolf sorts of attacks, you know, in this country. But I also think, you know, the American public has been kind of steeled for that for some time. So I don't think people are going to be surprised by that. But, you know, it's as Rick said, this is going to take a long and concerted effort to make sure that, you know, the proper intelligence sharing happens, where possible, military use is applied. But we're going to need a much more comprehensive approach that looks domestically and internationally in terms of how we are approaching this problem of radical violent extremism.
When you refer to much more intelligence sharing, I wanted to bring up something because I think it was either Secretary of State John Kerry or the president said in the last few days, more intelligence sharing with France will come from this and they'll be sharing more intelligence. What weren't they? No one's going to tell us what they weren't sharing, but what couldn't possibly have been that they weren't sharing already?
I don't know, Anne. I'm not sure what that means other than that we'll redouble everything we're doing. You know, I don't think that the communities of Muslim believers is the problem at all, not in France or here in the United States. It's a few radicals, small elements mobilized on the internet, many of them young men networked together in this, you know, more radical view. It's very difficult, you know, as it is to contain cults, to stop every one of these groups. The communities can try to help us police if they may hear of it more before others do. But I think much of this is happening outside of their reality and their zones in everyday life, too. It's a few people who, and they're surprised very often when it turns out that this 19-year-old kid was more radicalized than they thought or how he got radicalized. And since it takes so few, I mean, in the French case, we're talking probably fewer than a dozen who can then turn to people in the ISIS network for money. And ISIS has plenty of money. We need to try to attack that as much as we can. It's financial sponsors. But many of its financial sponsors are sitting in places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the Gulf and who knows, probably in Europe at this point. For me, it's going to take a lot of police work. I'm sure Interpol and the police are already doing a lot. They can try to do more. It's going to require that the rest of us have a bit of backbone, though, and stay a little bit calm and in a sense of not collapsing to the terrorists or the terrorists win if they actually terrorize us. I think that would be a real tragedy.
Well, we have mass shootings here almost on a regular basis in this country.
Well, not mass, not where we. I mean, remember what happened this weekend.
140 people.
140 people and 300 injured. This is way out of proportion to what we're used to.
I think the other thing I'd add, too, is that we're focused so much on France, justifiably so. And one thing I would also add about the nature of the targeting in France, you know, they really went after specific sort of cosmopolitan communities and communities where young people hang out, you know, and that's very political in their devious and shrewdness, you know, trying to target that. They target a rock concert, you know, and that's really targeting freedom and optimism for the future in a sense, you know. So they hit these places for a reason, and that's what makes it really frightening how soft these targets were, of course. But Rick's absolutely right, you know, we can't give in to that. I'm concerned about this anti-refugee mood because, in a sense, that's what ISIS would want, is for people to turn on these refugees, you know, and so I think we need to be very careful about that. We definitely have to have a very thorough regime of vetting people. But, you know, I mean, I don't know that that means we should stop, for example, a 2 or 3 year old, you know, orphan child from coming into this country, you know, and what kind of message would that send to the world if that's what we're doing, you know? So I think that's also important. And then finally, I would add, you know, Paris is really horrible, but, you know, like I said before, there was a civilian airliner down. There's been attacks in Lebanon. There's been attacks in Africa. There's been attacks in Turkey. You know, we've seen for about a 6 months now a very sustained terrorist campaign around the world. This didn't just come out of nowhere overnight.
But it's really important for Americans and everyone else to keep in mind that the people they're mostly fighting, people like Assad and his government, or Sisi, the military ruler in Egypt, or the Christian leadership in Lebanon, or the Sunni leadership in Lebanon, these are secular Arabs. Most of the Arab world is secular. They don't believe in these kind of ISIS extremists at all, and they're being fought tooth and nail. We can see what happened in Egypt against the Muslim Brothers as more secular-minded Arabs simply said, no way, we're taking control back from this. That's what Assad has represented. It's why he probably hasn't fallen, is because too many Syrians believe that the choice is between him and ISIS. And if that's what they're faced with, they're going with him. And so when we tend here in the United States to think all the Muslims are somehow in league with ISIS, which couldn't be further from the truth. Most of the Muslims are against ISIS, and ISIS is trying to attack them and dominate them through force and intimidation.
Email from Mark in Blacklick. He writes, I am embarrassed and saddened by Governor Kasich's refusal to accept Syrian immigrants. As a grandson of immigrants and as a friend of a wonderful Syrian person, I don't see any reason for Ohio to prevent families who want to be here from coming if they have been adequately vetted. Doesn't Mr. Kasich understand that when he reacts as he does, the terrorists win? Thank goodness the Washington state governor has some common sense and opposes the views of 15 other governors. Actually, I think it's more than 15 other governors now who have come out and said, of course, they have no legal standing to stop refugees from entering the state. But it sounds like the State Department saying, hey, don't worry. I mean, we're still taking the refugees. They're not going to force them on states. I don't know what all that means. But does that signal to ISIS, to the enemy, Sean Kay, that they're winning when people like Ohio Governor John Kasich say they don't want the refugees?
Unfortunately, this very quickly got caught up in political posturing. I don't know how else to explain
it. Everything will for the next 12 months.
Yeah, and I at one level I completely get, you know, people gut reaction sort of thinking, well, let's make sure that these guys can't get in here. I mean, they as Rick said, the notion that we fight them over there so we can't fight, so we don't have to fight them here. I mean, people can get on airplanes. You know, it's just a reality. So but I do think that, you know, we have to almost think of this refugee thing in broader strategic terms. You know, who are we? What do we stand for? What is civilization? What is it we're defending? And what we're defending is freedom. And so for people who've been, you know, brutally victimized by this regime and by ISIS, and for us to now turn our back on them, it's that kind of division and fear that terrorists are trying to inculcate. And I'm certainly not going to blame people, though, for feeling that fear, mm-hmm. because it's very real, you know, and it's understandable completely. But it was kind of a quick response to this problem, which is much more complicated than the sort of platitudes that often come out of political leadership. And what we need right now is fortitude. We're going to have to get some backbone here and move forward and try to find the best possible policy levers that we can pull while also achieving the maximum amount of security we can get. But, you know, we can never have a perfect situation. And literally to just sort of, as I said before, just exclusively say no refugees, you know, here, That's probably not good messaging, and it doesn't even really make sense. You know, what's a 2 or 3 year old orphan going to do? You mm-hmm. know, I mean, why can't we show an open arm to that child?
In a letter to the president, Governor Kasich referred to the deficiencies in the U.S. refugee settlement program. What do we know about U.S. policy and procedures in letting refugees into the country? What's he talking about? Do we even know?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on refugee policy, so I don't want to just sort of wing it here. How you could adequately vet, I suspect, is the problem, given the chaos back in the
records
region.
Records have disappeared.
Records and ability to know who's who and what's what. I sympathize with this. And just these last few days, the newspapers have been showing how some of the people who attacked in Paris just traveled through this checkpoint or checked that point. And the implication is, of course, that somehow security officials didn't do the right thing and didn't catch them beforehand, didn't connect the dots, as we used to talk about after 9/11. So if you're the administrator responsible for this, you're going to be ultra secure or ultra cautious because you're afraid it'll all come back on you when somebody slips through. It is important, though, to keep in mind that I think we won't know for a while still, but six or so of the eight who attacked in Paris were not coming from Syria for these refugee issues.
They could have had a tourist visa.
That's what I mentioned before. This is a much more complicated problem. The people who are following ISIS tend to get mobilized by the internet, and there's, you know, many of them are isolated groups of small, mostly young men. And young men can get mobilized into cults and extremist movements in all shades and varieties. We've seen this many times, and that's what's so difficult to contain. It's a very difficult policing problem.
It'll be, if I could add really quick,
sure.
Even more difficult actually for Europe, because they have this, one of the basics of European integration is this thing called the Schengen Accords, which allow for free movement of peoples across borders. It's the fundamental sort of premise on which the modern Eurozone economy and European economy is built on, you know, trade across borders, movement across borders. And so, you know, how that goes forward will be a very, very important question for how the European Union grapples with this in its context, which is also one reason why I think the French have preferred to take this into the European Union rather than NATO, per se.
An email from John in Prospect, he writes, I'm concerned that the media is essentially promoting ISIS when they run video produced by ISIS on their newscasts. What about that? What about how the media uses it? Of course, you can see most of this video anytime you want anywhere on the internet, but what do you make about the media's role in all of this, Rick Herman?
I don't think certainly the U.S. media is promoting ISIS. I mean, if there's a group that is being portrayed as absolutely evil, in my mind, is ISIS, and maybe President Assad has been demonized also, and that's made it hard for Americans to sort out because everybody seems to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
But I don't I haven't watched these ISIS videos, at least not on Western media, on the internet because of my professional role. I've seen some of it over time. So I haven't studied how much the American media is really running ISIS videos. My sense is it's very little. But I don't think we're running a lot of ISIS videos. I think mostly they're seeing, if people are viewing it, they're viewing it on the internet and they select to go to these sites. But I really don't know. I haven't studied to what degree American media is replacing, rerunning ISIS video. My guess is it's very little, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today and for your ongoing support of the show and helping us out and answering these questions. Rick Herman, he's professor and department chair of political science at Ohio State University. Thanks again for joining us, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
And Sean Kay, director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. Sean, thanks again.
Thanks, Ann.
We'll continue to have this conversation as events unfold overseas and in the United States. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael Demonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.